Blog Talk Radio.
Graham Hancock. You're listening to Earth Ancients with Cliff Dunning.
Yeah, happy day to you. Memorial Day. You know, I was thinking a Memorial Day, and this is a day in the United States, for those of you who live in America, that we remember our parents who served in the war, and the many wars. My dad served in the Second World War, was in the Pacific, and I was going through some old albums and found a picture of him in his uniform. My dad entered the service. I think he lied about his age, and he was actually 17, and he enlisted. And he was on a destroyer fighting the Japanese. and I was thinking about it because Obama was in Japan talking about the Hiroshima bomb that went off. 60 years ago. And now I was thinking about my dad, and he was blown off two different destroyers, and he survived. And it was just amazing. He would tell me these stories. And of course, back then, they didn't have all these psychological issues like, various conditions for nervousness and things like that. But I think he had some memory loss as he got older and struggled with a lot of the loss of some of his friends. In fact, one of his buddies that he was that survived one of these torpedo hits to one of his destroyers perished in the water. His name was Clifford, and so he named me after his lost buddy in the water. So we think about those who lost their lives this weekend, and those who are serving. And it just brings us around to the whole thing about wars. And, you know, it'd be nice if we could evolve beyond having to fight wars. It's just the level of this right now is kind of just the where we're at, you know. That's what we were born into. So we hope it all kind of gets settled at some point. But I don't know, in my lifetime, the need for military, multi-billions of dollars every year spent in military machines and soldiers and supplies and guns and things like that. Oh, boy. Anyhow, that's the thought today is for those who serve. So happy Memorial Day weekend. I want to make sure that everybody has a chance to check out the Facebook page, Earth Ancients Facebook. Go to the group page. We also have the international page. And this weekend, I am going to offer those of you who are Olmec fans, people who are interested in the Olmec civilization of Mexico. There's a new magazine put out by Michael Regari, and it's called Olmec World Magazine. And it's literally filled with pages and pages of Olmec discoveries. I actually posted a photograph of a new Olmec monument that was discovered that weighs close to a ton. on the coast of Mexico, in Mexico. Actually, it was discovered in 2002, but it was partially excavated, and then recently they completely excavated it, and it's a monstrous piece. You can see it. I posted it on the Facebook group page, and the unique part of it is they cut in to this volcanic basalt, which is one of the hardest stone rocks known on Earth, and the figure that sits underneath this table is quite unique. He has a kind of a head covering on, and he's got a really well-formed face, and he's sitting there looking out. And I mean, these guys are just masterful sculptors, and it's a fantastically huge monument table that you can see. But if you want to get a copy of Olmec World Magazine, send me an email. Send it to cliff@earthancients.com, and I'll send you a link that will give you not only access to the Olmec World Magazine, but there's another website that has all things Olmec, pretty much. So it's an opportunity to see, if you're really into the Olmec and some of that that artwork that they created, just fantastic. Cliff@earthancients.com, and I'll send it to you. A couple of weeks ago, we had Graham Phillip on the show, the author of The Lost Tomb of King Arthur. A lot of you really enjoyed it. I had a real big listener audience to that. And he has recently put out a short video of what he considers a Camelot, where the actual Arthur that he discovered lived and had a fort. And if you go to the Facebook page and you scroll down the bottom, you'll see a video by Graham Phillips. It's about, oh, I'd say 5 to 6 minutes, where he actually walks through this ruin. And it's quite fascinating. It's continually being excavated, and what they are uncovering is more evidence that it was a post-Roman fortification. The Romans left it when they left England, and they rebuilt it, and the figure Arthur, King Arthur, actually was there, so... go to the group page and you'll see it there. It's kind of interesting. The other thing I posted is some information that was released about a week ago. The archaeologist Al Goodyear, who earlier had made a discovery of pre-Clovis people in a place called Allendale, which is in South Carolina, has recently found the remains of an earlier people, which is fascinating. What's even more fascinating is these charred remains of bones, tools, and spear arrowheads date to 50,000 years ago. So the clock keeps getting pushed further back. And this is kind of interesting because there's a tremendous amount of debate if these are Clovis or pre-Clovis, and obviously it has to be pre-Clovis because their Clovis civilization is considered to be around between 10 and 15,000 years ago, and anything that's before that is, I mean, scientists are scratching their heads. But this is a professor from the University of Southern California or South Carolina, and he's been, with his team, has been out in this area of Allendale and doing a tremendous amount of research, and these carbon dates are amazing. 50,000 years ago, there was human occupancy in the Carolinas. So check that out. It's the article was posted just a few days ago on the Earth Ancients page. So continues to be fascinating what we're finding in America. It's quite old. It's older than we thought. In previous programs, I've had guests discussing the Mayan civilization, ancient cultures around the world. But there's more to the Maya, and I am fascinated by the Maya. I think, and I've mentioned this before, that they are collectively from a much earlier civilization. We don't know who that civilization is. We heard from Greg Little, who believes that they came from a sea-bearing culture in the Pacific. If that's Atlantis, great. I mean, Plato called that location Atlantis, but maybe it's not Atlantis. Maybe it's a collective of other cultures. We know that the multicultural of the Maya are very prevalent in the pottery work, in their art, because you can see the various types of cultures that are represented. But there's more to the Maya than just their diversity, their sophistication, their brilliance in science. There is something very sacred about their calendars, a spiritual science imbued in their calendars. And we have to wonder, the calendar, the most recent end date of December 2012, if the end date meant that, as the elders tell us, it was the end of one cycle and the beginning of another cycle. Conventional science say this is all crazy, has nothing to do with anything. And it's perhaps because their point of view is very askew, and they're just looking at it from a hard fact of here's the calendar, this is the date, and that's just another date, you know. My guest today, Dr. Carl Kelman, has actually written a tremendous amount about the Maya, and Dr. Kelman holds a PhD in physical biology from the University of Stockholm, and he's a leading expert in the Mayan calendar. He's authored The Mayan Calendar and the Transformation of Consciousness, The Purposeful Universe, and his newest book that we're talking about today is called The Global Mind and the Rise of Civilization, The Quantum Evolution of Consciousness. Now, I've read quite a bit of his work, and he's fascinating. He looks at the calendars quite differently than most people. Carl, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Cliff. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Great to have you. I'm really glad we can talk today. When did you first discover that the Mayan calendars were encoded with some, what I would call a sacred language or a sacred inscription that kind of is more on the conscious level than just numbers?
Well, I think that happened already in 1979, which was when I, for the first time, made a trip to Mexico and was backpacking around there. And then I was, for the first time, made known about the calendar. And I was told then that this was a sacred calendar, at least in the way that the Maya looked upon it. It took many years after that until I could start my own work to elucidate the true meaning of the Mayan calendar as I look upon it. But there was something really, in 1979, there was something really unusual with their calendar system. I understood that from the very beginning. I realized that what their calendar described were kind of archetypes or energies that characterized particular time periods, and that seemed to me as very unique and different from other kind of calendar systems, and it fascinated me. The whole question stayed with me until I started to work myself also, and of course I read what was available at the time, and the Mayan calendar, I mean, it's something that was virtually unknown until maybe the mid-80s or something like that. But then it became a phenomenon in the up until 2012, and many, many people had heard about it, but not so many people went deeply into it and to find out what these different archetypes, these different symbols would mean that could actually tell us something about the nature of time.
Right. Do you think that conventional archaeologists and anthropologists have mistakenly considered the Maya just a very anomalous group of people, but not much significance other than that?
Yeah, I think it's a profound mistake to look upon them that way. But there are also similarities in certain other cultures to their calendar system, so which tells us that they were not completely unique in the way they were thinking about time. And I think it's a I lost track there. I lost my train of thought.
Well, we're talking about the calendars, yeah, and how they are, the uniqueness of the Maya, and
yeah,
how science basically says, you know, current archaeologists are like, well, they're, you know, even though they were amazing engineers and they built these magnificent pyramids, you know, they just show up and, you know, there's nothing much else to say about them.
Right, right. Well, you know, it all depends on what kind of questions you're asking, I would say. You know, most archaeologists, they want to look upon the Maya as an isolated culture, as they do always. They always look upon cultures or civilizations as in isolation. There is another way of looking at these cultures that I'm applying in this most recent book and have been doing even previously, and that is to see how do they compare to other civilizations, what are the similarities, what would be the meaning if we don't just look upon the calendar as some kind of as a regular calendar, but actually look upon it as a calendar that describes the evolution of consciousness on our planet. What kind of conclusions would we draw if we look upon that? And that just doesn't happen in established science. It's almost, you might say, it's not allowed to look upon things like that. They always compartmentalize the various cultures. It's Neolithic Europe, there's the Maya, there's the Egyptians, and even though there's a lot of alternative researchers that are trying to make connections and so forth, it's not something that's part of the academic world to study. You know, the reason I would say is that, you know, one of the rules, it's now 20 years, I should say, since I was working in established science, but one of the rules there is basically that you may never do any research that would imply that there is some kind of a god or cosmic intelligence or a force of spirituality on our planet. That's absolutely taboo. And so when the thing is then, when you start studying the Maya and their calendars, you can't avoid those issues. You're almost naturally confronted with information that leads you to think much more deeply. And I should say, you know, in the history of of Mayanism, there's many unusual people that have made contributions for this reason, because it doesn't fit in. You know, you very quickly, when you study this culture and its calendar system, you're confronted with the big questions of life.
Let's talk about that, because you have actually delved into the consciousness that, you're the only one I really know of who's really delved into the Maya consciousness. And I have to ask you this. Do you think that the Maya possessed a level of consciousness that we don't understand? It's almost like they were time travelers, that consciously they could go to extreme distances and it's future times and then very distant past times. You see it in these calendars that are millions of years in the past, millions of years in the future. So in a way, were they kind of time travelers in a way?
I think one thing that you learn when you start studying them is how dominant their calendar system was in everything they did. To give a few examples, your daily diet, what you eat on a daily basis, was determined by the 20 glyphs, which is part of their sacred calendar system. So on a day that was, for instance, Jaguar Ish, they would always eat turkey. That was the day to eat turkey. And so their diet was based on their calendar system. Another way of looking at it, quite unusual, you might say, is that at least in post-classical times, they have sort of a rotation of the, maybe not capital in the modern sense of the word, but the central city of worship, so that they rotated in the four directions. The city that was dominant, the capital, based on their calendar. So every what was called the katun, which is a little bit shorter than 20 years, the capital would move to another place. So the calendar determined where and when the site of the capital would change. And just these two examples tell us how dominant their view of the calendar was in everything they did. When it comes to the question of whether they were time travelers, I cannot really tell that based on what I know about them. But all I can say is that time as such was very significant to them, and their whole system of governance was based on whether a king could track back his ancestry to certain shift points in the calendar. So certainly they would travel backwards in time and connect to the shifts that they were aware of in the calendar system. And then to some extent they would also use the calendar then to travel forward. There would be a ceremony on a 360-day basis where they would always take out their old books, their old codices, and the people that were the priests, they would gather at those points in time when there was a minor shift in the calendar, and they would prophesy. They would say what, based on their time knowledge, what they expected to come in the year ahead. So that sort of implies some kind of time travelers traveling also into the future.
Mm-hmm. What makes Mayan calendars unique and different from other world calendars, other civilization calendars? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think the most, and it may be surprising to many, but what I consider the most important difference is the fact that their calendars were not based on the astronomical cycles. I think, in the discussions up to 2012, a lot of people missed that very point. But, like our Gregorian calendar is based on the solar year, it's an astronomical cycle. And many other calendars are moon calendars. That are the Muslims and the Jewish calendars are both moon calendars. So they are based then on the revolution of the moon around the Earth as a monthly cycle, so to speak. And the Mayan calendar system is much more metaphysical. It's based on shifts in energies. It's based on shifts in consciousness. And those shifts are not, at least according to the Maya, they are not based on these astronomical cycles. So when you think about it in those terms, you may realize that while the rest of the world had materialist calendar, physical astronomical calendars, the Maya calendar actually are like more like wave movements of shifting consciousness. And that's why I think you have something very unique to learn, we all do, from the Mayan calendar system, because it points to shifts in the human mind. And when those shifts take place in the human mind, or the global mind, as this book is talking about, then humanity changes. And so it tells us something about not only about our past, but about our future. And in my worldview, anyway, consciousness is primary to the material reality. And because consciousness is the primary thing, it's a fantastic thing to have a calendar system that actually deals with consciousness and maps out how it's going to change, and does so, in my view, very, very effectively over time.
So this is an important point that you make in your book, and actually it's in all of your books, and that is the calendars are designations for levels and different shifts in consciousness. Now, how did you find this out? How do we know? Because it's hard to tell when our consciousness is shifting. We don't know. It's a subtle thing. If we're imbued with, as Jose Arguello said, we're being imbued when he described the harmonic convergence, it would be an unconscious change, a wave of energy, or a wave of, I think he called it solar consciousness or something like that.
Yeah.
That we'd be bathed in this energy that would shift our consciousness. Now, how did the Maya understand this, and how is it relayed in their calendar?
Well, I think a lot of it is when you study the different symbols that they were using to describe their different time periods. And for instance, one of their important calendrical tenets was the idea of a 13-step cycle, which could be a 13-day cycle, but it could also be 13 steps in a much, much longer time perspective of so-called katuns and baktuns and even alautuns, reaching steps, 13 steps of a billion-year-long cycles. And when they describe these 13 steps, they use symbols. It could go, for instance, from the hummingbird to the macaw, or it could go from the seed to the mature fruit. And then it's also the 20-day signs that they're using to describe the 20-day cycle that I mentioned, just about, you know, how they follow their diet based on these 20 glyphs, 20 symbols. And sometimes I would say that these glyphs are fairly straightforward in interpreting them. For instance, then, you know, if you have a sequence of 13 that starts with a little hummingbird and which I happen to have right out of my window at this moment, and goes then through a number of larger birds, ending up with these majestic macaws, then you understand they meant something by this. It wasn't just the symbols thrown out to give names to the different time periods. No, it tells us that it was a process. These 13 steps was like a wave movement, a process that went from a seed to a mature fruit. And there is a lot of information like that. And of course, it's subject to interpretation. But I have made it into my task to correlate these symbols that they were using with what we, from a modern archaeological and historical perspective, know about these time periods that were described by these symbols.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. You know, in your book, you say that around October 28, 2011, the shift, the 2012 shift, which is the end date of the calendar, would take place, and you actually left and went away to experience this. What did you experience anything at that time, the October 28th period?
I think some background should be given that the main thing about the Mayan calendar system is that it's like 9 different levels of evolution. And up until October 28, 2011, these were 9 steps, 9 levels, which each went through 13 steps of going from seed to mature fruit. And what happened on October 28, 2011, was that all of those processes came to a completion, or at least all the 13 first steps in these processes were completed at that particular time. And the highest of when you compare these different waves, these different sequences of 13, which are wave movements, really, you find that the higher the level, the higher is the frequency of the wave. So what had happened in March 9th, actually, of 2011 was that the ninth and highest of these waves, highest both in the sense of the evolution of consciousness, but also highest in the sense of the highest frequency, that was activated. And that was a wave that brought a frame of consciousness to humanity that did not have any filters. It was a unity frame of consciousness. And in 2011, what happened as a result of this shift was that there was a tremendous movement of protest all over the world. This is the time of the Arab Spring. This is the time of the Occupy movement, etc., etc. And by the end of the year 2011, after the shift, you might say, Time magazine made who always designate the person of the year, decided that there had been so much protest in this particular year that they said that the protester would be the person of the year of 2011. Mm. And of course, that's not what would be discussed, how that correlates to the Mayan calendar. It would not be discussed in the public media or anything like that. But what had happened was that March 9th, when the veils were removed and this new wave was activated, people started to see suddenly that this world is not a world where everything is united. It's not a world where the leaders are seeing that everything is connected and where we should sort of take care of the world as a world where everything plays a role and everything should be considered. And so these people started to protest in the Arab world. The protest was against all the dictators, mostly the secular dictators that had been there. And in many other parts of the world, it was like the Occupy movement. We are the 99%. Was their main slogan, saying that there needs to be a kind of there must be a change in direction of how our world is going. And so this is sort of the background. So far, I think, you know, honestly, I must say my predictions up until October 28, 2011 were many times remarkably accurate. Where I was, you know, if where I wasn't sufficiently clear about what would happen would be where would the world go from from October 28, 2011. And in that regard, I think I made some mistakes. I couldn't see that what actually did happen was that the waves were just continuing. There was actually wasn't any discontinuity on that particular date, October 28, 2011, but there was a shift. So, you know, when you're talking about wave movements, as we're doing here, they will alternate between the peaks in the wave and the valleys in the wave. And what actually happened on that date was that all the waves would go into a valley state, so to speak, into what I call these waves, these peaks and valleys, I call them days and nights, respectively. And what happened was that in the immediate result was that they all turn into nights. And then what has come after that is more complicated. It's something I'm coming out with a new book in December of this year called The Nine Waves of Creation, which is also published by Inner Traditions. And I consider it my strongest book that I ever written. And that deals with how did the shift go into our current time, and how is our current time determined by the energetic calendar system that the Maya devised 2,000 years ago, approximately. And
right.
What I assert there is that it's just as relevant as ever, and it has, you know, much of what is happening in the current world after the shift can be understood in the right perspective from the Mayan calendar.
Can you talk a little bit about the shift that took place after 2012? I mentioned Jose Agüelos. In his book, The Mayan Factor, he describes shifts in consciousness. And in some of your books, you talk a little bit about it too. But can you describe what the Maya understood regarding shifts in levels of consciousness and why this 2012 calendar shook so many people up? I mean, it's like the religion... Different religions of the world said it was an end date, and certain people said, well, the earth's going to be blown up and things like that. It was very negative in this connotation,
yeah,
but
yeah.
That's not what the Maya meant. Maya meant one cycle ends, another cycle begins. But can you tell us a little bit about what you understand the consciousness level of this shift is?
Yeah, well, unfortunately it is a fairly complex thing, and that's why I'm coming out with a second book about it this year. But one thing that I think has to be said is that in order to understand the shifts, you have to understand that there are nine different waves, and that each of those different waves provides a certain state of mind to humanity. And I differ from most people that study this when it comes to pinpointing the actual shift date. So I place it at October 28, 2011, and I think this corresponds much better to what actually happened in history. When you think about the year 2012, it was actually a year when there was very little drama going on, and certainly the shift date didn't really mean anything, the so-called December 21, 2012
right.
date. If I'm My own view then is that there was a significant shift then in 2011, and but the most positive aspect of this is that the ninth wave was activated, and it brings a mind to people a mind that doesn't have any filters that basically looks upon what goes on in the world through light, through a perspective that supports unity, and that was activated. And you know, if you consider what people look upon the world today, you know, it's sort of a strange mixture, I think. Because, you know, some people can rightly find very terrifying things that are going on in the world, and many would say that the world has gone crazy, and there's a lot of truth to that. But some people would also say that, well, this is a year of enlightenment, and they experience the unity and the sort of like a spiritual divine experience of the world. And the surprising thing maybe is that both of those perspectives are right, in the sense that but you have to be aware that different waves are carrying different aspects of the shift. And some people will then be, at the current time, they will be in resonance with the ninth wave that gives the unity consciousness. But a lot of people are still in resonance with the sixth wave, what the Maya would talk about as the long count, and which has now gone into a night. And the result of that going into a night is quite different. It carries some very difficult challenges for humanity to deal with. So it's not like everyone in the world is affected in the same way by the shift that happened in 2011. We are affected differently depending on which ones of these waves or what interference patterns of these waves that we are, each one of us, is primarily in resonance with. And it's that complex situation, you might say, that means that when we look at the world today, we can look upon it, we see the very positive trends, but most people will also see some very negative trends. And we'll be faced with this is a complex situation, and but it is a situation, I would say, that can be very meaningfully understood from the Mayan calendar.
What are some of the signs of the shift in consciousness or shift in mind that this newer wave is bringing? Can you give us some examples?
Well, I think you see it when you, the kind of information I will listen to on the internet, you will see, a lot of people wanting to be more connected to nature. You see a large concern about eating natural foods, these are things that come from the ninth wave. These are things that you know, where you see your connection, everyone's connection to nature, and experience it spiritually. I would say as well. Then you will seek these kind of things. I think you see it in you know, the reactions to the climate change. I think you see it in people protesting against chemtrails and many aspects of our current reality comes from these lower waves. And at this time, You know, the ninth wave, the unity conscious wave, it's only been active a very short period of time. I mean, it's like 5 years most. And what that means is that, you know, people that were fully born into this wave are less than 5 years of age. And they are not yet shaping the world, the world of politics, the world of big decisions. That would take another, at least 15, but more likely 25 years or something like that. And so we're heading to a world where this unity consciousness will increasingly will come to dominate. But that path that goes through dealing with a world that has been created by the lower waves, which, you know, are not based on the kind of unity consciousness. They are mostly based on a dualistic frame of mind. And this is very actual, I should say. You know, it's not just sort of describing the minds of people as being dualistic as a temporary thing. People, it goes down. It's a very profound resonance that's been created for a very long time, and that frame of consciousness is really the problem that we have to face today. And eventually, I'm sure that the ninth wave will be victorious. The people that resonates, the world belongs to the people that are in resonance with this particular wave. But it's not something that will happen on a particular date. You know, there was all this talk about a particular date, December 21, 2012, when a lot of people thought that's the date when things would change. And that's not at all how the Mayan calendar works. It's not like everything changes on any particular date. Instead, these wave movements that they described as shaping human civilization, they manifest over much longer periods of time. And we should be aware of this. And we shouldn't just sort of be, pessimistic, because it's more of a long-term thing than people have thought. We should see that overall we are part of a plan that is sort of exerted upon the entire universe, where our own Earth is a part. And that plan has the direction of unity consciousness. The plan is designed, you might say, by the higher intelligence of the universe to transcend the dualities in thinking that existed, that were brought by the lower waves. And these dualities really what has caused all the inequalities and all the injustices and so forth that we know from history. But it's also the duality has also sort of created the mentality of human beings being in the right to dominate nature and to use nature, rather than, you know, seeing the connection, seeing the unity of everything that is created. And that is something that will come only with a ninth wave.
It's interesting. You know, in your book, you bring up a topic that is interesting to me and a lot of people, not a lot of people, a handful of writers are bringing up, and that is the difference between mind and brain. How do we know for certain that the mind is something that we download and is not created by the brain?
Yeah, it's a, I think a basic way of looking at it is that our brains that we have today basically took their form about 150,000, 160,000 years ago, when Homo sapiens emerged on our planet. And that brain has really not changed since then. It's the same brain. At the same time, there's been a tremendous civilizational development, especially in the 5,000 later years. But you know, you can, if you go back 40,000 years, as I do in the book, you see that all in accordance with these symbols of the Mayan calendar system, you see that humans start to change. They become able to create art. They become able to create tools of a diversified nature, and these shifts, you know, these new abilities that I in this book, I correlate them with the shifts in the human mind that takes place on these particular time points when they begin. And from that, you may conclude, I would say, that it's an evolving mind, but it's a constant brain. And and the conclusion that I would draw from that is that the mind is something that we download, and this downloading, it happens at significant shifts in the Mayan calendar. I would like to give a very clear example of that that comes from the book. And this is that the so-called long count, which was, you know, really the most important aspect or calendrical aspect of what people were discussing prior to 2012, that particular wave, that particular calendar was activated in the year 3115 BC. And the Maya actually describe how this shift that took place then, what it meant, because they looked upon it like a global phenomenon. They describe it as a global change that took place at that particular time. And the way they describe it is that like a global grid of energy lines corresponding to the four directions, and you might say the four meta directions as well, you know, meta directions being northwest, southeast, and so forth, that this grid was activated on our planet. And that's really the only information that we have from them. But how does that, you know, what did that mean to the human mind? Well, what I'm saying here is that as this happened, the human mind similarly became, through resonance, it became dominated by a mind of straight and perpendicular lines. You might say that our consciousness was compartmentalized by the mind that was downloaded at this particular time. And so what happens when such a shift happens on the level of consciousness is that humans will project onto their external reality the inner change that happened inside of themselves. So, you know, it is this principle of as inside, so outside. So once that shift happened 3,100 years ago, the straight and perpendicular lines became part of the human mind, we can see in how on the outside, in the external societies that they created, they, for the first time, they start to build structures like the pyramids that are straight and perpendicular, and very much in the case of the Egyptian pyramids, they are exactly aligned with the north, the true north direction. And so it's sort of as inside, so outside. And it's not only that, but the fascinating part is that this was a global mind. That's how the Maya described a global shift that took place in 3115 BC. And so it's not only in Egypt that they started building the pyramids at approximately this time, but at the same time, they have, you know, professional archaeologists have dated pyramids from Peru and from Mongolia, different parts of the world, and several places in Europe as well from that particular time. And why? Well, because the mind changed. The mind, when the mind changes, the external technology changes. And that's the birth of civilization. The rise of civilization occurs at the time when humans start to download straight and perpendicular lines.
Let's talk a little bit about this download, because you bring up two points in your book. One is the global mind and then the human mind. Are you referring to the global mind as an intellectual consciousness that is permeating the earth, and then the earth humans are downloading that, and that's becoming the human mind? How does it work?
Yeah, I would say so. That's probably exactly what I have found.
So there's an intelligence, there's a global intelligence that we are downloading, because our brain,
yeah,
the actual brain is just a body part, and it's the mind that,
yeah,
has all the consciousness and the information. So,
right.
So this is interesting. If we talk about this, the global mind, this is a consciousness that we cannot describe, but maybe the ancients understood this consciousness in a way that they could describe it, and as it comes forth and becomes our earthbound brain, or excuse me, earthbound mind,
yeah,
that's evolution.
Yes, absolutely.
Huh.
Absolutely.
Well, that's, yeah, fascinating. So,
yeah,
so what is the source of global mind? What is that, like a, is that something that is just part of the physical universe, or is there dimensions to that?
Oh, I would say that there are dimensions to it, and I think, you know, it comes most immediately. It comes from the global mind, or in the human minds, our resonance created with the global mind. But then I think the global mind is also in resonance with the galactic mind, which is in resonance with the cosmic mind. So it all seems to be like a cosmic intelligence, I would say, that ultimately is behind this. And it's sort of a mixture, I would say, between a physical aspect and more metaphysical aspects. There is, on the level of the inner core of the Earth, there is a straight line that separates the western and the eastern hemispheres of our planet, and that's something that was discovered in 2011 by geophysicists, and that is sort of a physical aspect of the inner core of the Earth that creates different kind of resonances on the western and the eastern hemispheres. But the nature of these waves that are creating the resonance they probably fairly similar to sound waves or something like that. But it's hard to exactly describe in terms of established physics. All you can say, I would say, is that when you correlate these waves that the Mayan calendar describe, when you correlate it with what we know from human history, it just matches up amazingly well. So there are these waves there, and ultimately I think they come from the cosmos as a whole, as from the cosmic intelligence. And the way the physical design of the universe has been made is in order to create life and create higher levels of consciousness according to this time plan.
Yeah, someone has to start studying these, and I don't know how they would do it because we don't have any technology that measures unseen geomagnetic. We can measure geomagnetic fields, but consciousness fields, these levels of consciousness, global consciousness, is a fascinating concept, and it's people like yourself, Carl, that are explaining it in current terms as best you can, relating to the Mayan, because the Maya were the only culture that maybe there's other cultures that were able to actually describe it in their calendars and in their symbology. The other thing I want to talk about is the Maya were a pyramid culture, and they played great. They paid great attention and built complexes that included, at least in most of the cities I've been to, with different types of pyramids. Now, why is the pyramid so important in their culture? Did you get a sense of that? You also describe the Egyptian, the Great Pyramids. But is there something, is there a reason for that? I mean, I'm just curious on that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I basically look on these pyramids as the downloads that the mind is making at a particular point in time. So that's sort of why how I explained that 5,000 years ago, people started to build pyramids in Egypt and a couple of other places, because their mind was changed, and the mind had incorporated these lines, these four directions especially. They started to project that reality by building big pyramids. And I, you know, part of it, I think, is that they wanted to honor the divinity or the gods that had given them these lines, because these lines were also the root of civilization. And in those early days, I think people were very happy about civilization. At least that's what we can gather from some of them. When it comes to the Maya, they have a little bit of a different focus compared to the most ancient pyramids 5,000 years ago. The Maya are very much expressing their calendrical wisdom, their calendrical knowledge through their pyramids. And so, but this calendrical wisdom, you might say, is then also a way of expressing what they experience as a divine plan for the evolution of the cosmos. And for example, if you look at the most significant Mayan sites, such as Palenque, Chichen Itza, Tikal, and a couple of others, their most majestic pyramids in the centers of their cities are built in nine levels. They are terrace formed, these nine levels, and so they were actually metaphors or descriptions in stone of the calendrical system, which was also based on nine different levels, nine levels of evolution of consciousness. And if you think about it, climbing one of those pyramids, it also meant sort of climbing the nine levels of consciousness. And so the kings in their cities, who were the only ones that were allowed to do this, essentially, they were seen as embodiments of the cosmic plan, and they did so by climbing the different levels. So I would say that the Mayan pyramids have somewhat of a different message and function compared to the Egyptian pyramids. But they're all reflections of the same, one and the same cosmic plan for evolution, and where the Egyptians put the emphasis on the straight and perpendicular four directions, and it's facing the north, exactly the true North Pole. The Mayas pyramids were more elaborate and sort of, not only did they do these nine-storied pyramids, but sometimes you find 13-storied pyramids or five or seven, and you can understand these different levels based on the knowledge that we have from the different signs and symbols that were describing the calendar system. So they they're more grounded in the temporal evolution. The Mayan pyramids are more based on the time-wise evolution of consciousness, whereas I would say the Egyptian pyramids, they reflected the initial downloaded of the linear mind, of the perpendicular mind that happened 5,000 years ago. So there's a difference.
Now, I've actually climbed the El Castillo at Chichen Itza. I don't think you can climb it anymore. And when I went up there and stood up in the very top, I got zapped. I don't know what had happened to me. And I had to come down very slowly because, and I'm beginning to wonder if those pyramids were designed as consciousness collectors of some kind. And I wanted to ask you if you've ever had that experience too. And I've not been to Tikal, and for the most part, I don't know, other than the World Pyramid down there, I don't think you can actually climb on any of them because they're just so damn high up and people fall off.
You know, I'm glad that I went there in 1979 because at that time you could climb all the pyramids, but it seems you have had the same experience there, that once you're up there and are faced with going down, you maybe think that it wasn't such a good idea to climb it because some of them are, you know, they're slippery but I think we had the same experience there. What I think is that, you know, it's one thing to sort of sit down with your notepad and scribble down information about the calendar in as a very mental exercise. It's another thing to actually climb a pyramid like that, where you get the calendrical information through your entire body, just because you're doing the climb. And so I'm not I've had the same experience. I think it's a fortunate experience to be able to climb these pyramids, and it goes into your body, it goes into your marrow, what's the information there.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's necessary to actually climb it, but maybe being around the base of the pyramid, you still pick up, because if these are collectors of this global energy, it's going to kind of bathe everybody around it. So I know at Uxmal, for years you could climb it, and then some fools fell off of it and died, and then they shut the door on that. Plus, they're very ancient structures, and they probably can't take the weight bearing of hundreds or thousands of people climbing them. But do you have a feeling about these Mayan complexes and the possibilities? Because I get the sense that they had an understanding of the Maya had an understanding of energy that we don't understand. And it seems like some of their buildings may be imbued with this cosmic energy. And if you're able to kind of shift your consciousness, you can kind of read them and understand them. I think if you're psychic, you could probably pick up on information. But do you have a sense of any of that, anything to describe?
The there might, you know, I think I provided a rational explanation to it, but, you know, outside of the rational or explanation, there might be much more cosmic direct experiences, and it's almost like it's a consequence that you can't really describe that, explain that rationally. But all I want to say is that, you know, their pyramids and many of their structures in their cities were built as reflections of the cosmic plan and the cosmic energy. So you know, it doesn't surprise me if many people experience such things down there in many ways. And many times they are multifaceted as well. I mean, like the Chichen Itza pyramid that you mentioned, it's something you can climb, and you can go through the various calendrical shifts by climbing it. But then there are other aspects to it where, you know, they have this jade jaguar hidden in it that you can visit that brings a certain energy certainly to the pyramid. And there are these echoing phenomena when you clap your hands at a certain distance from the pyramid, it echoes back. And there's so many things there that, you know, I think just will have to be experienced. But I do want to say that the cities had other functions than our modern cities. These sacred sites or these they were built to reflect, I would say, a divinely guided cosmic plan, and that's different from our modern cities at the very least.
Interesting. In the few minutes we have left, Carl, can you give us an idea, short of predicting, or maybe that's the only thing you can do, of what the current activation wave is going to bring us and what we can expect?
Yeah, well, it's a total of 9 different waves that are active, and all for the first time in the history of humanity since 2011, all the 9 waves are active. And the 5 highest of these waves are, you might say, mental waves, and they're creating the evolution of the human mind and the human spirit. And it's a complex pattern of interference between these different waves that we are living through now and will continue to live through in the future. I believe that without setting any kind of date, we're beyond any kind of date, or I would even think that we're beyond prophecy in the old sense that it used to be. I believe that there is a plan that is being executed through our resonance with these 9 different waves, and that plan is meant to take us to a golden age. A golden age then meaning that the minds of people will be so much changed that we will sort of much more literally see that whatever we do have consequences for others, and in everything we do as individuals, we will be subordinating that to the needs of the larger whole. And now, in the current world, in 2016, we don't see this directly. A lot of people are sensing the shift that has happened, and many people experience that the frequency increase, that things are going faster, that came with that particular shift. They experience that. But most immediately, you know, we see the effects of lower waves, the waves that separate us. from each other, that brings minds, that separates us also from nature. And in the most immediate future, and maybe talking about at least 10 years, at least until 2031, we will, you know, it will be like a, you might say, a struggle in the world between these forces that are seeing this, how the destiny of humanity is actually intended through these nine waves as a plan to bring a golden age of unity. But we will be faced with all the consequences in the near, at the very least in the near decade, with the consequences of lower waves, with the consequences of people experiencing themselves as being separate, which is really what these lower levels of minds are bringing to people. And I at this point do not want to make specific predictions. I don't even know if it's possible. It's so much up to the choices that people make at this particular point in time. But I think we will we are having some very difficult things to deal with at least in the decade ahead. And but yet, you know, the very fact that the ninth wave bringing unity consciousness was activated and will forever continue to be accessible for our resonance does point out that that's the future of humanity. That's where we're supposed to go according to the cosmic intelligence that designed this whole plan for evolution of different waves.
Okay, so so you can't give us a sense if we're coming up on a renaissance of such of culture or whatever. It sounds like there is some potentiality of, you know, more positive levels of society.
Yes.
We are going through a hard part right now.
Yeah.
But would you say that there is, your feeling is that there's some good things to look forward to in the coming decades, or is it going to happen sooner?
I think of it in terms of decades, and I also think of it very much in terms of how human beings are setting their intentions, what they actually want to do. And I also think that spreading the knowledge of the Mayan calendar is part of an emerging new worldview, which would support these kind of trends that are possible. You know, if people are not aware of the different waves that the Mayan calendar describes, they're much more inclined to believe that there is no positive change coming, and much more easily falling into thinking that what the world looks at the current moment is sort of what it is, and it won't change. But the knowledge of the Mayan calendar, it tells us that the world is going somewhere. And I think at this point we still, you know, there's still the working out of a truly new paradigm, which would allow us to see exactly that's the plan. The plan is towards unity consciousness, and but that hasn't quite happened yet. There are many things that are sort of being worked out. Things have, the way of thinking have changed since the shift, but we're only in the very beginning of it, and it's very much dependent on us where the world will go.
That's fascinating. The book is The Global Mind and the Rise of Civilization, The Quantum Evolution of Consciousness. My guest today has been Dr. Carl Kelman. Thank you very much, Carl. We're looking forward to this upcoming book, but this book here has got a lot of really fascinating areas in it, a lot of great chapters on pyramid culture, consciousness, and the various waves that you've been describing. So actually a bit of a history lesson in here too, which is quite nice. So thank you for that. Thank you for your work.
Thank you very much, Cliff. And I really appreciate having the chance to talk to someone with a lot of background about ancient civilizations and so forth.
It's been fun. It's been real fun. We'll check in with you again when the next book comes out. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you. So that was my guest today. Now, this book is now available. Actually, it's been available for the last few weeks on Amazon, The Global Mind. And I really suggest people get it. It has a good description of these waves. And there's just a tremendous amount of information about the Maya that Carl's brought out. And I strongly suggest people get it. The Maya are really a fascinating culture. And boy, it's too bad we don't have more documents from them. They were all burnt up, unfortunately. And so all we have is the four codices and then a great deal of standing stones. So books like these are really a great way to understand who the Maya were and what the significance of the calendars were. So you can get it on Amazon. This coming week is Contact in the Desert, which is an international conference in California held, and it's on ancient aliens and UFOs and things like that. We don't really support ancient aliens on our program, but I was fortunate enough to grab a hold of Eric Van Doneghan, and he's going to be on our show next week. And if you don't know who he is, he's the father of the ancient alien movement and the theory, or you can call it a hypothesis. And he'll be talking about his latest book, but it's a good opportunity for me to talk about what tipped him, what has been the foundation for the whole movement. We had Giorgio Tsoukalos on the program a few weeks ago, and we did hint at Eric's influence, his great influence. And as we know, as I mentioned, Giorgio was a big influence, has been continuing an influence, and he's the host of the TV series Ancient Aliens. So be fun talk next Saturday, June 4th, Eric Van Doneghan. I hope you'll join us. And the day is Memorial Day, so I hope you do enjoy it. Have a great day.